Welcome to hour number three of National Post Radio. Here's your host, Anthony Fury.
I was saying earlier that NDP leadership candidate Nikki Ashton has really made a threat to all of Canada in a meeting in the Toronto Star. She says, oh, don't worry, Justin Trudeau isn't going to outleft me. I will severely outleft him, saying that income inequality and climate change are the two most pressing issues. I beg to differ. I think economic prosperity in general, because when she says income inequality, I think she means making people wards of the state and all these wealth redistribution programs and so forth. But regardless, income inequality, a huge conversation everyone's having. Now, normally when we break it down, we break it down by like quintiles, you know, top 20%, bottom 20% of income earners and how things have shifted over the years. But there are other things that have shifted along the decades that maybe we aren't taking into account when we look at these numbers, such as divorce rates and separation and family composition, things that have wildly changed over recent decades. This is all covered really robustly for the first time in a report out by the Cardis Institute, a think tank based out of Ottawa, in a study called Missing Family Dynamics. Longtime Canadian public policy analyst Mark Milkey joins me now to discuss this report that he authored for the Cardis Institute. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Anthony. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, always a pleasure to chat with you. Hope you're doing well. And this is a really interesting policy study, kind of somewhat uncharted waters. First of all, tell me why, and you've done many studies looking at different sort of economic issues and data sets and so forth. Why from this angle? What first got you guys onto this?
Well, many things, but I guess one of the things that spurred me to write this study was something I read in a book that you may be familiar with by J.D. Vance, a lawyer from down south who grew up in the Appalachian, grew up in Ohio, but his cultural roots are in the Appalachian Mountains. And he wrote a book called Hillbilly Elegy. And in it, he talks about, you know, how he grew up in a very dysfunctional family culture. Right, his mother had multiple boyfriends. His father was pretty much absent for a good chunk of his life. Despite that, though, he managed to make it through life, to make it through school. But this had a lot to do with the influence of his grandparents and others who took an interest in him, and even his mother and father at various points in his life. But it seems like his grandparents were key to him getting ahead. And at one point in the book, he also talks about we hear, and it's a sentiment many of us would agree with, that we need economic opportunity. It's something I've written about, and so I'm not disavowing that. But he points out that he's in this factory one summer working his way through law school. Again, you know, this is how he's paying for his education. And he's working with this other couple in this factory who are probably 19, 20 years old. The girlfriend is 19 years old. She's pregnant. And both the girlfriend, this couple that he knows, and her boyfriend have lousy work attitudes and lousy work ethics. And eventually they end up getting fired. And they needed the jobs. And so it occurs to him they had economic opportunity and they blew it. So what else is going on? Because it's not just, as maybe interventionists might say, like Nikki Ashton, well, we need to spend more money through government. Well, maybe you can find some instances of that. The governments do a lot of that already. Maybe people need economic opportunity. Again, I agree with that. I think if you don't have jobs and an income, of course, we're hooped. But what he pointed to and what I point to in my study is that we often don't think about these family or cultural influences or faith influences that can sometimes shape attitudes. And those aren't easily measurable, but sometimes they matter as much to outcomes as some of the other things we talk about.
Yeah, because generally when we do a public policy paper, report or whatnot, there's recommendations at the end that say, and the government should adjust this rate to this bracket by 0.3%, and that'll solve the problem. And of course, this is not really measurable in that way, but you know, clearly productive nonetheless, if not even more so. What did you find, Mark?
Well, so you can measure some things, and it gives you a clue as to what's going on, but it doesn't necessarily tell you why. But it also affects, it should affect the debate, for example, on poverty or inequality. Though you have to break those two apart, given the different dynamics. But let me give you an example of what I mean. In my study, I found that if you look back to 1976, and you look at family composition, almost 72% of the country of households were two-parent families with children. In 2014, it's less than half, so 49%. that's a pretty big drop. Now, what does that mean for, say, inequality statistics? Well, what it means is we know, for example, usually two-parent families or two-parent households, rather, married couples with no children, since they're a bigger part of the population, and most people in those relationships, married couples, no children, are working, of course you're going to see higher incomes for that household. And so when you look at inequality statistics, you may make the mistake of thinking something's happened in the greater economy. Well, no, not necessarily. You've got, these days, more couples that don't have children, and all of a sudden they're way up the wealth scale relative to everyone else. Well, what does that create when you look at the inequality stats? It creates more inequality. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You've simply got people that don't have kids and both work, and therefore the stats are going to bend because of that reality. And so you got people like Nikki Ashton or others talking about inequality, not understanding there are these family formation influences that are affecting the statistics.
So how should that factor into how we devise public policy and just how we think about our lives in general?
Well, and here's the tough one, I guess, because, again, when we go back to cultural influences, if families break up, for example, let's suppose you've got a one-income family of $50,000 and they break up, and all of a sudden you've got two households with $25,000 each. All of a sudden you've probably got two poor households relative to the one middle-class household you had before. That's not necessarily, the poverty's a bad thing. The breakup may not necessarily be a bad thing if someone's leaving an abusive spouse, for example. But what we have to keep in mind is governments can't always solve these sorts of things. I would say this, what government should do is, of course, never harm the social fabric of society, never harm families. Like, stay away from any programs or weird ideas that come out of academia or government sometimes that may damage or fray what's called social capital. A lot of theorists have talked about over the years, but what most normal people would just call family, faith, community, these sort of unofficial, non-government, things we do every day. We help other people, right? Organizations, nonprofit organizations like churches and synagogues and mosques that have involvement in people's lives. I think governments need to be very careful.
And those stats are also declining too, Mark. The involvement in sort of civil organizations, whether it's church or the Rotary Club.
Exactly. And so, again, this isn't something government can be involved in. Maybe we as individuals and families need to think about where we can serve our community a little bit better and help people out that way. Again, we live in a universe, though, where, especially in the policy world, we look at data and then we say government should do X. Now, there's obviously a role for that. And, I've spent most of my career looking at what governments do or don't do. But we can't forget that there are these other things. I mean, this couple that J.D. Vance spoke of in his book that had bad attitudes, there's no government program that can solve that. But there may be a parent, an uncle, maybe some institution nearby, maybe a church or a Rotary Club, like you said, that, if they get into contact with people that care about them, can say, here's why you're failing, and let me try and help you not do that.
But again, we're joined by Mark Milken now, a policy analyst who's written an interesting report for CARTIS Institute, a think tank on missing family dynamics. Mark, I guess the challenge is there will always be the push for government programs that, while they don't solve people's, I guess, life skills challenges or what have you, they will maybe insulate them from having to solve those issues. Some sort of, even broader, bigger program that can make you more of a ward of the state. I think sometimes from the Nikki Ashtons of the world, we hear those as solutions. And without a doubt, if people aren't paying the bills for that month, we got a problem. And if we can help out, we should. How do we factor all that in, though?
Well, I would say this. Try and keep top of mind that not every person can be helped even by that. So, and this again points to the importance of everything that happens outside of government. So, clear example. Let's suppose you've got someone who makes a great income at $100,000 a year, but is a compulsive gambler and lays pretty bad bets. Is there anything that government can do about that or should do about that? I would say no. They're going to have to hit bottom. And often you will find this, of course, in people that deal with pretty desperate cases in other spheres, that people do have to hit bottom, and sometimes there's nothing you can do except be there on an individual level. But certainly in the example of the gambler, there's nothing that government could or should do about that. I would say government sometimes end up doing too much in certain spheres, and sometimes saving people from their own choices in some cases. Now, obviously, again, there's a rule, and we already have plenty of that in our society, right? I think it's great that a single mom, for example, can get tuition, you know, can get a student loan or get a scholarship and help raise her children on her own. I think that's entirely positive. That helps people get out of poverty because single parents have the lowest incomes in the country when you look at family formation. But beyond that, beyond what we already do, again, let's not forget there are these other things happening out there that affect poverty statistics, that affect inequality statistics. And there's not necessarily an easy answer for that on the policy side of things, except to say, are we really sure as people living in this country that there are not things we might want to do more often, volunteer more often with, and help people out in our neighborhood? We forget that these social ties matter sometimes a lot more to outcomes, at least in the immediate, than some of the big policy stuff.
Mark, do you think that there are policy issues, though, to deal with this sort of, whatever you want to call it, fraying social fabric? I mean, it seems like increased divorce rates and single-parent families are the new normal, but they're maybe not the best for family composition. How do we respond to that?
I think there could be, but it's a bit of a long link, if I can put it that way. I mean, I don't think that, I don't think that it's necessarily a bad thing that divorce rates have risen over the past 50 years. Again, if that means that people don't stay in abused relationships.
Right.
So I don't think there's anything governments can or should necessarily do about that. I do think, for example, governments need to be sensible on things that are related to things that are more easily measurable that we know are a problem for, say, poor households. So, for example, the government of Ontario never should have embarked on policy that made power bills in Ontario so expensive. Governments across the land, whether federal, municipal, or provincial, should not be making the development of housing so expensive. This gets to the housing issue in Toronto and Vancouver and elsewhere. There are things that I think cities, you know, should avoid doing to make housing more expensive. And that, you know, if you can have cheaper housing, then you solve some of the problems of how am I going to pay the rent this month, right? But by restricting supply, governments do a lousy job. Unintentionally, they end up making life more expensive. Well, who does that hurt? It hurts the poor. It hurts single-family households who have low median incomes relative to the rest of us. So though there are things that governments can do, they're not directly related to the cultural developments that we're seeing in the United States and in Canada. Down south, though, they talk about it a bit more than we do.
Mark Mulcahy is an independent policy analyst, did a paper for Cardis Think Tank that you can find on their website at cardis.ca. Mark, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony.
Lauren Gunter standing by to talk to us about, well, speaking of Ontario government screw-ups, no, it's not the rollout of the energy prices. No, it's not the gas plant scandal. It's the LCBO pot decision, the CCBO. And it tells us something about the federal government's pot plans. Gunter breaks that down for us in just a moment here on SiriusXM Canada Talks, Channel 167.
Major League Soccer is live here on Canada Talks Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. Vancouver Whitecaps hope to improve their playoff position as they host lowly Minnesota United FC.